and we depended on the conduct of racism, because traditionally in the discussion of biology has implicitly either meant or been feared to be in the discussion of racial issues. Now we know that racial issues are
My sister was not like that at all. So it was as though, just as I wrote, an alien had taken over her body, and I did not know how to respond to her at the time, which is really one of the reasons I wrote this book, because mental illness is this sort of third party in a relationship of two, this phantom presence that can go in and out, and you never know when it's going to hit next.
And I know that a lot of people define mental illness by the movies they've seen, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or that movie with Michael Keaton, Dream Team, which was just hilarious, but they see it as a kind of in their mind by it, they just treat people. But I have to tell you, Victoria, that mental illness is not extended to my experience. My mother's mother was mental illness. It's a long story, but then my sister-in-law had a significant break in her early 20s. And the thing that I observed, I have a disabled daughter, I'm looking at New York City, and people have tremendous sympathy for her physical disability. But I saw my mother-in-law, on the other hand, struggling with a phantom daughter, a daughter who has looked like her sister at times. And the grief was just so overwhelming, and it never ends.
Well, if they look normal, first thing about mental illness is an invisible disability.
Mm-hmm.
If you see a child who clearly has physical disabilities, such as cerebral palsy, or all he has, is retarded, or, can't see, or blocked with a stick, or whatever it is that you have a relative who looks like they'll be okay, and suddenly it's time to really get out of time, and then you have to come out of it, and you have to work, put the finger on it, and you have to put the finger on it, and you have to put the finger on it, and you have to put the finger on it, and you have to put the finger on it, and you have to put the finger on it, and you have to put the finger on it, and you have to put the
She covers the issues just in depth. We're going to touch on it, but here it is if we can go through it. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. The book is called When Madness Comes Home. Off the video.
All of the people who are
and these pressures. And in that sense, pollution is a very healthy thing because it's forcing us to become aware of ourselves as a species.
Yes, I quite agree with this. In fact, in anthropology, we had the equivalent of social facts must be explained by social facts that Kroger and Leslie White especially put forward, that cultural phenomena can only be explained in terms of themselves. Well, which is, nothing can be explained in terms of itself. Everything, whatever it is a product of the operation of processes at some other level of phenomena. And one has always, when one is trying to explain how something works and why it is the way it is, one has to reduce down to some next level of phenomena below for that explanation. At the same time, one has to move up to a higher level if one is into a phenomena of organization, if one is wanting to look at what the effects of the things one is examining are. As to what effects, you sort of go up in the hierarchy of orders of phenomena, and if you ask how come, you go down. And if you ask what is it, then you're concentrating on the content of the order itself.
I wonder whether I may go back to the point that Dr. Tiger made and just...
Bombardier, I'm all right. I'm all right.
Thank you.
yes, can have great practical value. I remember during World War II, I was with a research organization in the Army that was doing attitude and opinion surveys, which involved having soldiers fill out sometimes quite lengthy questionnaires. We used the Army General Classification Test scores as a device for sorting the populations of respondents to our questionnaires into those who could handle a paper and pencil situation by themselves without feeling threatened by it, as against those who were not able to deal with this very well, and whom we then had personally interviewed by interviewers with a questionnaire instead. And the AGCT test was a very, very good sorter of people as to those who could handle paper and pencil situations as against those who could not. But
Lysenko in Russia, which is a very useful idea for managing people who are recalcitrant. I think that this notion that we have to go beyond freedom and dignity, unfortunate title, is based on pretty poor science, was a totally unjustified extrapolation from rats and pigeons, even more ridiculous to humans. And then, with political implications, Fred Skinner is so naive as to completely misunderstand. And I think we have to be very careful here about taking this as a representative of what psychologists try to do.
Well, Dr. Tiger, are you saying that Skinner's proposals are dangerous because they will work or because they will not work?
The human being is a very stubborn animal, and you can get mental patients, as some Skinnerians are now doing, and you can put them on money economies with tokens, and they will respond while they're in hospitals or in prisons or in other places. But this is precisely the metaphor which I think some of us are upset about, because it does not work easily in the real world. And while it may work in some sense, anything works to some extent, and I think what people are frightened about is a version of the human implicit in that model which is not going to work in the long run. Remember, it was the young Hungarians who'd been most subject to the brainwashing or the persuasion of the Russian government who threw stones at tanks. And it's the young people in this country who've been most stimulated by the educational system to accept that everything is good who have been throwing stones at tanks symbolically. So we have to be very careful.
I think, however, that we have to recognize that the problem that Skinner is addressing himself to is, and the reaction to it, that in this there's some things that are quite complicated, and there is no doubt about the fact that a great deal of human behavior is not genetically determined in any precise way, and is therefore open to conditioning in one direction or another. There is no doubt that operant conditioning works in all kinds of ways. People's behavior can be very significantly affected by reward-punishment schedules, and especially by the patternings of reward schedules, which Skinner has pointed out. My wife, who's a school teacher, has applied it very successfully in dealing with certain kinds of behavior problems in her own classroom, for example. She systematically laid down certain strategies of behavior for herself in relation to the children in the classroom, and the response that you want comes out, and it's a pleasanter place for them and for her to operate in. Now, from one point of view, this is, of course, the gross manipulation of behavior. We should remember that people are constantly trying to manipulate one another's behavior. Parents are concerned about the behavior of their children and working to manipulate it all the time. Children are concerned about the behavior of their parents and trying to manipulate that, too, in various ways. So that we are, as a species, manipulators of one another. And that, I think, is the first point we should understand. It's a given, and we're not going to stop being manipulators of one another. The second point is that we are quite capable of being manipulators. We are manipulators in all sorts of ways. There are, however, limits beyond which the effort to manipulate, as we have pointed out, and produce the But the idea that Skinner adds
to while it was a rogue. This is on television. When I'm watching television, not just radio. Not but it's wrong when it was a rogue.
And he used all the colors that I normally wore when I was on radio.
They use my wife is named Mary, and they talk about Jesus' mother Mary, and they do it in such a way by constantly referring to different Bible verses from which have the same number as her.
People are manipulating one another's behavior and are always looking for ways of making the other guy act the way he wishes he would so it cannot bother him and see if he bothers me. That's a big concern. And so we have social problems today, and where a lot of people are just waiting to walk on the streets and hide in the cities. Now, we can only have some gimmick whereby we could program all those people that frighten us so they won't frighten us anymore.
It's the bar.
Germ warfare, which is bad, I think, in the real sense, and I don't see any problem with that.
You like him!
Very knowledgeable in these matters. The trouble is, we take a piece of knowledge that we have about man and his behavior and then start assuming that that is all there is to know, and that's the whole story. And establishing policy. Talked about, say, having the state take children away from the mothers so that they can condition children in certain ways and so on. Standard of living of the sort that you're talking about, what we need is a great deal more knowledge than we have now about the highly complex ways in which human beings operate. And what we have to do in the meantime is be exceedingly modest about what we know, not to indulge ourselves in proclaiming that we have a lot more useful knowledge to offer than we really have. And be constantly on guard against the kinds of uses that people try to, what the motives are that they have for putting their knowledge to use. So I think as one reviewer of Skinner's work said very clearly, what one gets is a picture of him as a man who disapproves very much of the way other people act. People are constantly trying to manipulate one another's behavior. Parents are concerned about the behavior of their children and working to manipulate it all the time. Children are concerned about the behavior of their parents and trying to manipulate that too in various ways.
I'm going to go to the hospital. Yeah. along with the swab and brushed neatly into a regular boy's hairdo, a few springy locks and top loops, curly hair. Ah! The nose was a pale blob of cold putty. Had the police already gotten to me? No, I was born like that. At two, my face already looked like the face of a convict. But the eyes and chin were pretty. Pretty. When I was four, I got polio. I was paralyzed from the neck down. I could barely turn my head. My flesh withered. I didn't see my face again until I was five and a half. The cheeks had collapsed. A young death's head. Taut, bony, unlined forehead. The chin had turned hard like a frozen lily. The eyes glowed the color of green figs. I opened my mouth. A blood-soaked bird's nest in which the mother bird had been killed and her fetal offspring left to die in their unhatched game. A mouth full of meat and feathers and tiny white coffins. A fat pink worm snarled from the red gash in my face. I watched my tongue moving in the mirror and crawl. Red was my favorite color. I took a tube of my mother's red lipstick and made big red X's on all my dad's business stationery. My father hit me in the face hard. I always wanted a red face and black hair. Straight black hair, dark crimson face. Instead, I had curly mouse hair and a bleaching face. I thought of cutting my face up with a razor and pouring shoe polish on my head, slicing off my ears. I went to the bathroom and looked in the mirror. The blood was a pathetic little dribble. I cried. When I was six, I got glasses. Glasses temple pushed my ears out even further and made them swell and blush a painful pink. Other kids made fun of me. I was the scrawniest kid in the whole school, too. I walked with my toes pointed in because of the polio, and I had to wear big, bulbous orthopedic shoes. My face mirrored my self-consciousness and embarrassment, probably even in my sleep. All through my school years, I was one of the ugly kids. My mother bought me a pair of stylish black horn-rimmed glasses. They only enhanced my pallor. Other kids' faces turned brown in the summer. Mine looked like a cheap mask of blistered pink rubber from a joke shop. In the fifth grade, I proposed to a girl named Denise Johnson out on the lunch court. White blobs of seagull and pigeon shit rained from the sky. Denise said she wanted me to propose properly between the gym and the cafeteria after school. I combed my regular boys and wiped my modern glasses. At 3:10, I met Denise between the two buildings. I was shivering and my mouth was dry and tasted horrible. I got down on my knees on the shit-splotched black top in front of Miss Johnson. My mouth was just level with her groin. I looked up at her pretty brown face and long, straight black hair. She looked down at my damp cheeks and smiled benignly. Denise, you are the prettiest, smartest girl in the whole school. Will you marry me? You're too ugly. You look like you've been whooped with an ugly stick.
He wonders if he too might have made a similar mistake.
Thank you.
Larry didn't like what he saw. The cheeks of his mother, the eyes of his father, as each day crashed around him, future stood revealed. He was turning into his parents. Stepping out of the shower, Harry stared at himself. His hairline receding, a slight overbite. He picked up the razor to begin his shaving on thought. Oh, I wish I was different. Remind me of my father, and I don't want to be reminded at all. The final disappointment. He looked in the mirror thinking of Vincent Van Gogh, and with a quick swipe, lopped off his nose. And happy with that, he made a slice where his chin was. He'd always wanted a dimple, the end of all illusion. Then peering down, straight between his legs, Harry thought of the range of possibilities. A new face, a new life. No memories of the past. And slit his throat from ear to ear. Up with a cough. The stitches made him wince. A doctor smiled at him in front of him. Somewhere across the room. Son, we saved your life, but you'll never look the same.
Her face has changed. Snarl. Misty lavender donuts of shame appeared in front of my eye. Suddenly, a mob of snickering boys and girls jumped out from around the back corner of the cafeteria. They surrounded us, laughing and jeering. I stood up, wobbling, a lump in my throat, my asshole pinched tight. Denise joined the circle of snapping, cruel children. She stood next to Rudy Stoltz, the handsomest, most popular boy in the school. They held hands. Fuck you, Jew-ass bird butt, said Rudy.
Or you fled a mausoleum of the devil once.
Shut up enough long enough for me to pray. Jewish. Jewish.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
So they began solemnly, dancing round and round.
Oh,
Alice.
Dear.
Every now and then,
beautiful,
treading on their toes
so,
when they passed too close.
So rich and
and waving
me.
Their forepaws to mark the time.
In a hot
while
tree.
A mock turtle sang
who
this
for such dainties would not stoop.
And sadly,
soup of the evening.
Will you
the
walk on the
said a white into a the snail.
Evening,
there's a porpoise close behind us. And he's treading on my tail. See how eagerly the lobsters and the turtles all advance. They are waiting on the shingle. Will you come and join the dance? Will you? Won't you? Will you? Won't you? Will you join the dance? Will you? Won't you? Will you? Won't you? Won't you join the dance?
Any other dish. Who would not give all else?
You can really have no notion how delightful it will be when they take us up and throw us to the lobster out to sea.
Too far.
Mabel looked at Sam. Sam thanked the lobster kindly, but he would not join the dance. Could not join the dance.
Beauty.
What matters if it's how far we go? There is another shore upon the other side.
And found
the further off from England, the nearer is to France. Then turn not pale, beloved snail.
Join the upon the chimney piece. He looked again and found it was his sister's
won't
husband's
you?
Niece.
You?
Unless you leave this house, he said,
will you join
I'll
the
send for the police.
Will you?
He thought he saw a rattlesnake that questioned him in Greek. He looked
won't
again and
you?
Found it was the middle of next
won't
week.
You join the dance?
The one thing I regret, he said, is that it cannot speak. He thought he saw a banker's clerk descending from the bus. He looked again and found it was a hippopotamus.
If this should stay to dine, he said, there won't be much for us.
Mouse.
He thought he saw a kangaroo that worked a coffee mill. He looked again and found it was a vegetable pill. He thought he saw a coach and four that stood beside his bed. He looked again and
mine
found it was a bear without a head.
Mine is long and a sad tail.
Poor
said the mouse,
thing,
turning to Alice and sighing.
All right, kids, now
it
look
is
up.
A long tail.
Way up to the very tip top of the circus tent.
But why do you call it?
Do you see that
bear?
Thin wire across from those two poles? Well, in a little while, three men and a girl will climb up the ladder to that platform, get on a bicycle, and ride across that wire. Boy, it takes a nerve to do something like that. You know, if I weren't a clown, I think I'd like to be a daredevil more than anything else in the circus. Wouldn't that... But, oh boy, kind of scary, too. The high wire...
I took her down into my depression. I wanted her to view her face, but I never told her what I felt. I put her through the cold silence treatment. My only cowardly weapon in reaction to being insensitive and treated by someone I so badly needed to trust, believing out of my own insecurity and need to believe certain things can't be true, and that the world is good like me. So I blame her and them for having deceived myself into believing them to be what they, but I wanted them to be not what they are. I took myself those emotional traps whose cold spirit is punishment of the other in reaction to being like a fool who can't face it. I put her through the cold silence treatment. Nothing hurts your ego like being treated like she's not there. I take it to the extreme. I enjoy the thought she must be feeling dead. I enjoy the feeling of victory, even supremacy. Then I'm alone in my victory, because I haven't really killed her. Because the thought of her isn't dead, but continues to be the silent motivator behind this trap. This old silent treatment chipped me in.
The other daredevil acts have to practice. Why, it's even harder than playing the piano.
When the dark shadows creep, and the world is asleep, in the still of the night, baby creeps down a flight. Then he looks all around, without making a sound. Then baby toddles up to the telephone and whispers in a baby tone, "Hello, Central. Give me no man's land. My daddy's there. My mama told me. She tiptoed off to bed after my prayers were said. Don't ring when you get my number, or you'll disturb Mama's slumber. I'm afraid to stand here at the phone, 'cause I'm alone. So won't you hurry? I want to know why Mama starts to weep when I say, now I lay me down to sleep. Hello, Central. Give me no man's land. I'm alone. So won't you hurry? I want to know why Mama starts to weep when I say, now I lay me down to sleep. Hello, Central. Give me no man's land.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?